Hey everybody, welcome back. This week I have Dan Bacadal, who you probably saw on The Daily Show. He's had parts on 30 Rock, Flight of the Conchords, all kinds of stuff. And now he's on the show Legit. He's also on Veep. Legit runs 10:30 on Thursdays on FX, and Veep is on HBO. And so please, you know, check them out. He wanted to talk about Rodney Dangerfield, and I was just so glad because it's a new album. It's on vinyl. That is new to us. We haven't talked about it before. And honestly, it's great. Just, you know, give it a listen. We've got, clips throughout this one. It's simple setup punchline, but really great, well-crafted setup punchline that you don't hear anymore. Because once stand-up comics and comedians in general discovered irony, anything that was old-time funny was no longer of interest. So hopefully people can rediscover this. You know, obviously it's probably not a form that's going to come back, but it's something you need to appreciate for the time. It's great. Done preaching that. So enjoy the episode. Thanks so much.
Hey everybody, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to Comedy on Vinyl. This week I have Dan Bacadal. Thank you so much for being in here. And I said it right, correct?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good, because
you nailed it.
Okay, because most people pronounce my name Clam, and it's Clom. And so yeah. I always do the reverse, I always assume.
Well, when you have the double consonant, you're supposed to elongate the vowel.
Right, right.
And we don't.
Right.
My family doesn't, but that is the correct pronunciation, is Bacadal. But it was a great bone of contention when I was on The Daily Show.
Was it?
Because Jon Stewart always said Bacadal,
and
I said,
right.
It's actually Bacadal.
That's probably why I
And he
I
didn't like that.
So you wanted to talk about Rab and Rodney.
Yeah, I'd rather talk about that than The Daily Show.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine.
That's okay, though. I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
No. It's all about you. Why did you pick this album?
You know what? I got to be honest. I picked this album because you told me, when we first were in contact, you said the last person had just done the Cheech and Chong Wedding album, I think?
Yes.
And my first choice would have been Cheech and Chong Los Cochinos, which is the one with Basketball Jones.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And Evelyn Woodhead speed reading and Chibornik and all that on it. And I thought, you just did a Cheech and Chong.
Right.
I'm not going to saddle you with another Cheech and Chong. A year and a couple months later, it probably would have worked. But what I did instead was I went, okay, then what else is there that I actually listened to that I didn't think would be so oversaturated? I mean, like, anybody could talk about Bill Cosby himself.
Sure.
And if they can't, they should not be in comedy at all. I'm talking to Carlos Mencia, who claims to have never heard or seen the greatest comedy act in the history of comedy.
My God.
Bill Cosby himself, hands down, the greatest comedy act,
oh my God.
In my opinion. And Carlos Mencia claims he never saw it. Okay.
I'm pretty sure he's not going to come on my show.
Yeah,
so
well, that's okay, but okay. You're better off for it.
I think so.
So I didn't choose those based on that stuff.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, I went for Carlin AM/FM because I figured that's an obscure one that people would say Class Clown or A Place for My Stuff.
Right.
And I figured rather than saddling you with another one that everybody wants to talk about. So then I went to, what did I actually listen to that I wore the grooves out of? Now, mine was a cassette tape, so I played it until it went and was warped in my car, and that was Rappin' Rodney.
That's awesome.
And a big reason for that was Back to School,
the
film.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the album predated, I think the album was obviously after Back to School. And I had been a big Rodney fan just because of the work that he did in Back to School and the work that he did in Caddyshack. I knew nothing about his stand-up. And when I became aware of Rappin' Rodney, whether it came out before or after the film, although I think it was after, I kind of wore it. I wore the grooves off it.
It's insane. I had never heard it before.
Did you listen to it?
I listened to it today at work.
Did you pay attention to the fact that there can't be another comedy album in the history of the world that has, on average, and I counted them today, 6 jokes per minute, 6 laughs per minute.
Jesus Christ.
So one laugh every 10 seconds, almost like clockwork.
Yeah.
Almost. And then there's the point where he says, he screws up the joke where he's talking about his daughter.
Yeah.
And he says, my daughter, she's a dummy. You know, she's another one. She was taking her driving lessons. It took her 6 lessons just to learn how to sip up. And I fucked that one up. It took her 6 lessons to learn how to sit up in the back seat. And even with that, he still manages to get 6 jokes into that minute.
Yeah, you know? And it's kind of the last vestige of that type of comedy.
Old school.
Nobody was
set up punch. Set up punch. Yeah. Set up punch. Set up punch.
But it didn't really drive me crazy. I thought maybe like, you know, I try and put myself in a headspace where I have to appreciate it. I didn't have to try that hard.
Yeah.
So I always forget how filthy he can be. Not filthy, but like that he can swear. You know,
he was a swearer for sure. I apologize ahead of time.
It's really okay.
Okay, good.
It makes the show better. I think we've had one iTunes complaint, but fuck that.
Really?
Guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
He's like, oh, you guys are really intelligent. You say some wonderful things, but
I'd prefer to buy my comedy at Walmart where they censor it for me. I just lost you one.
That's fine. That's fine. That's cool. I don't need Walmart shoppers. Subscriber. That's okay. That's really fine. Do you? Was this like? Did you listen to this with other people, or was it you?
Yeah, Bill Carpino and I were big Rodney fans.
Uh-huh.
Bill even followed him into Easy Money, which I just couldn't get into the film. I just couldn't get behind Easy Money. It never really worked for me.
Yeah.
And he went into Easy Money and loved it. I was stuck in Back to School and loved Back to School, top to bottom. Managed a movie theater at the time that Back to School came out.
Mm-hmm.
And owned the one sheet, the original one sheet that hung in the theater.
Awesome.
For that film, probably sat in there and watched that thing two, three dozen times.
Holy shit.
And so in that respect, I was a huge fan
mm-hmm.
of his work. But like I said, I'd never really paid any attention to his stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stand-up wasn't really my thing. It wasn't until, and that was about that same time, but even then, I had kind of only reserved myself to Cheech and Chong, Los Cochinos. I've never listened to any of their other albums.
Okay.
And it was because of Basketball Jones that I liked the album.
Mm-hmm.
Later in life, I discovered what they were talking about in a lot of the other sketches.
Where I'm like, right.
Oh, Buster the Body Crab. That guy's got crabs. That's what that is. And I honestly did not understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the stuff with Sergeant Stadenko, didn't get it. All the drug talk, didn't understand what they were talking about.
Nope.
Just loved the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Cosby himself, George Carlin, AM/FM, and Eddie Murphy, Delirious,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Sure.
Which was another one I could have asked to talk about, but I'm guessing a dozen people probably asked to talk about.
I want to say we did the first one. I don't think we've done Delirious yet, actually.
Oh, well, Delirious was the one that got me.
Yeah.
So I'd listened to those, but I'd never been really a fan of stand-up. I didn't...
Mm-hmm.
That was pre-cable era,
sure.
at least in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
So there was no half-hour comedy hour. There was no Comedy Central. There was nowhere to see comedy other than going to a club, and a 12 or 13-year-old kid doesn't go to comedy clubs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just not the way it works.
Sure.
So my comedy was... Oh, and also, what am I talking about? Steve Martin.
Of course, yeah.
So Let's Get Small and Wild and Crazy Guy.
Yeah.
And even to a much lesser extent, Comedy Isn't Pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy's Not Pretty.
Yeah.
That third album, which bombed and is terrible, but I still own it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I loved listening to that stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't really make the connection that these guys had worked very hard to craft and create these moments.
Right.
I just thought, you know, I came from a funny family. My father was funny.
Mm-hmm.
My brother is maybe the funniest person I know. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. he's a prosecuting attorney for the state of Florida, so very unfunny in his profession.
Probably a busy man, though, in Florida.
Yeah, yeah, very, very busy man. But he still does comedy. It's just in a different, you know, depends on which side of the bench you're sitting.
You're right.
But so I had a lot of funny people around me,
mm-hmm.
and people told me I was funny. I always suspected they were just being nice. And so I just figured these guys got up on stage and talked about their lives, and that was that.
Yeah.
Never dawned on me that they had written, practiced, rehearsed.
Sure.
Pained themselves over, what am I going to say? On this Rodney album, mm-hmm. for example, he talks about kids these days. You know, oh, kids these days. That's another thing. They're wild, I tell you. My kid got a box of Cracker Jack. The prize was a diaphragm. And I thought, why diaphragm? Why not condom?
Right.
Because diaphragm is a funnier word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, when you get down, and I'm guessing that people that are going to listen to this are going to be interested in science of comedy.
I hope
it's
so.
It's not going to be the casual listener that's going to go, I'm going to listen to a podcast about comedy.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a comedy podcast, but one about comedy, at least when this guy's sitting with you. And to realize that, like, they go to the pain of finding the exact word.
Yeah.
The one that would work best.
Yep.
You know? And so I hadn't really paid much attention to it. But when this came out, when mm-hmm. Rap and Rodney came out, first of all, rap was pretty new.
Yeah.
So to have an old dumpy, bug-eyed goofball doing a quote-unquote rap really appealed to me.
Yeah.
And then to hear it and to hear, you know, I got a kidney-shaped pool with a stone in it. And to go, oh, man, that's good, right. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit of that cheesy old school.
I tell you, I'm all right now, but last week I was in rough shape, you know. Last week I looked up my family tree, two dogs were using it. What a family I got. They traced my roots back to a cesspool. My old man, he was a beauty, my old man. He was a workaholic. Yeah, you mentioned work, he got drunk. My old man. All his money went on booze. I was 6 years old. I found out there was no such thing as Alpo baby food. I don't know. I tell you, I can't relax, you know. Well, the other day I called up my wife. I said to her, honey, I've been thinking about the last time we had sex. I'm getting excited. She said, who is this? My wife. When we got married, she told me I was one in a million. I found out she was right.
It's like I said, it still works. Did you? I'm assuming then you must have had a much deeper appreciation once you started actually doing comedy, though.
Yeah. Well, you know what I did was I did comedy in class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like Carlin always talked about the occupational fool.
Yes.
And he spells it with an E.
Uh huh.
You know, make it that much more interesting. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my thing. It didn't matter where I was fooling around. Mm-hmm. You know. I didn't have any aspirations of being in comedy because I thought it can't be done. It's
right.
Just the chances of you becoming one of those six people on SNL are 0 to 1 million.
Sure.
Let's just stick with something that might work better, like
okay.
child psychology or sociology.
Oh, shit.
Or communications
mm-hmm.
or history
mm-hmm.
or economics
uh-huh.
or political science or any of the other millions of things that I tried before I finally settled on, all right, fuck it, I'm just going to have to go into acting.
Yeah.
So I went into acting. And I was in school up in St. Cloud State in
mm-hmm.
Minnesota taking acting classes, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And we read a play a day, and I loved it.
That's
I can't
awesome.
Believe I enjoyed reading plays.
Yeah,
I would have thought that that was somehow less than manly back then, but I was into it. And I drank my way out of that school and had to go back to Florida. I grew up in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And worked my way through community college to get into Florida State University because I knew they had a pretty good football team.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to go to a place that had a good football team.
Yeah.
Because it was really important to be a fan of a team that was going
right,
to win.
Right, right.
Not, it had nothing to do with the, you know, education or
sure,
any of that.
Sure, just.
And they also happened to have a very good theater school.
Yeah, yeah.
So I enrolled in communications school.
Uh-huh.
And found out that I didn't have the grade point average.
Mm-hmm.
And probably never would.
Right,
type
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
I was like an ugly girl on The Bachelor, where they kind of said, like, what are you doing? Or, what are you delivering? You can go now. And so then I joined the theater school and started doing plays. And
mm-hmm.
I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And I had a friend who wasn't getting cast in plays at the time, this guy named Sean Daniels, who is, I mean, he was getting cast in plays, but he wasn't getting the recognition he should have gotten as an
uh-huh.
actor. And now he is artistic director of the Jiva Theater, I think it's called, in...
Mm-hmm.
Up in Rochester, New York.
Oh, okay.
He ran the Actors Theater in Louisville. He was artistic director or of some sort up at Cal Shakes up in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, an amazing mind for theater, production,
yeah.
directing, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, he started doing improv with a group called the Whammo Players.
Okay.
Whammo.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Frisbee.
Right.
Because, you know, the funnier the name, the funnier the group.
Of course. That's
know.
How it always goes.
And I went and watched those guys, and they would do it at... I forget the name of the place now, but it doesn't matter. But it was a place in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm.
And we just couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I just could not believe that these guys were making this stuff up. I knew they practiced and rehearsed, so
yeah.
I figured some of this has got to be, you know, they rehearsed this bit, and then they're going to do the bit.
Sure.
Come to find out, talking to them, they don't.
Yeah.
It's all improvised.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was scared to death to try.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing worse than doing comedy and it not working.
Right.
You can do drama and fail, and people just go, well, this is boring.
Yep.
You do comedy and fail, and people are, they get mad.
Yeah.
They actually get mad.
Yeah.
Because you've entered a contract.
Yeah.
And they go, you broke the contract.
Mm.
So, I toured the country with a theater company and went through Chicago and saw The Second City.
Yeah.
And the show that I saw was terrible at the time. I won't say the name because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I've become friends with a lot of these people
right,
now.
Right, right, right.
And I don't think it was their fault. I think it was just the environment there at the time. They were
sure.
in between moments of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if it's this bad, I could move here and do this. So mm-hmm. when the theater tour was over, I moved to Chicago. And I went and saw the show again. And mm-hmm. it was a different show this time, and I will tell you the name of that one. That one was called Paradigm Lost.
Okay.
And that was Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, Scott Adsit.
Shit.
Oh, fuck. I'm screwed. I can't get in here.
Yeah.
This guy Adsit looks like me.
Right.
And he's hilarious.
Yeah.
And this Dratch chick, she is the next Gilda Radner
uh-huh.
times, you know, Phyllis Diller plus name the funniest woman you can think of.
Yeah.
And Tina Fey was obviously brilliant, and Jenna Jolovitz, and Jim Zulevic, and,
mm-hmm.
and Kevin Dorff, and I just Shit. And Scott Allman,
uh-huh.
rather, and I just went, damn. All right, well, there's good theater in this town, so I gave up again. And I said,
yeah.
I'll go do theater,
mm-hmm.
and I did theater around town. I did some good theater, but eventually that thing started speaking to me again. That said, you've always been funny. You've always wanted to do comedy. Go do comedy. So I started taking classes at a place called Players Workshop,
okay.
in Chicago. And I started taking classes at the Improv Olympic, which is now I.O.
Yeah.
And I started taking classes at Second City. And I started rising through the ranks pretty quickly. Within
uh-huh.
2 years of taking classes, I was on the touring company of the Second City. And usually it takes 4 or 5 years.
Right.
I think more than anything, again, we might have been in a vacuum there
uh-huh.
or a bit of a dead space. And I just happened to... I was older than everybody else, and I had theater experience, so I didn't
okay.
have to be taught. Turn around and face the audience when you speak. You know, that
right.
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And... So I rose to the top pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, wow, I'm suddenly doing comedy all the time now.
Yeah.
I was just an actor.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
now I'm doing comedy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after doing the main stage in Chicago, I got the offer to go to New York and do the Daily Show
uh-huh.
with Jon Stewart. And I did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then left there and moved out to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Did a little bit of TV work, a little bit of film work. And somewhere in there, I hit a lag. I wasn't working,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like I needed to do something. I continued to do shows constantly.
Sure,
I was doing shows
sure, sure.
at UCB LA. I was doing shows at IO West. I was doing shows at Second City Hollywood. And as fulfilling as it was from a standpoint of, I enjoy doing this work,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't pay the bills.
Right.
In fact, you got to pay for parking and gas.
Yeah. yeah.
So I was losing money.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking of a way to... kind of change that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can I change the tide? And my friend Steve Kaminsky had just moved out here,
mm-hmm.
and he was like, I've been thinking about doing stand-up. And we had another buddy named Brian Jack who started working over at Flappers in Burbank.
Uh-huh.
And he said, they got an open mic day, basically afternoon, and you get up there and you get your 5 minutes, and afterwards the guy gives you notes. And I was like, fuck, what? Okay.
Yeah.
What more protected way can
yeah,
I possibly
yeah, yeah.
find to do this? Other than taking a class, and I don't want to pay for classes again.
Right.
I did that for 2 years.
Right.
Each in 3 different places.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So I've spent my $2,400 in classes for acting, and I'm done.
Yeah. Other,
you know. And so my first time up, I had a loose idea of what I wanted to do
uh-huh.
on stage for stand-up. And then I discovered that you can't really do that unless you already have a lot of experience.
Right.
And I had thousands of hours of experience in improvisation, but I did not have a single moment's experience of standing in front of a microphone.
Right.
So I do things like, and loosen the mic stand and take it up and down and go, oh, now I know why those guys are always messing with the mic stand. It's because they're nervous. I guess that means I'm nervous. Hello. All right. So my name's Dan Bagatol, which is a weird name. It's Norwegian. This guy over here goes, woo, and I go, fuck you. And then I go, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. Why did you say woo? And he goes, because I'm Norwegian. And I said, no, you're not. And I kind of like get in a fight with this guy, and I go, oh, this is what I do on stage in improvisation.
Right, right.
This doesn't work right. in stand-up. Unless you're already established and that's your shtick. Your shtick
right.
is, I attack the audience and people who like to be attacked come to watch.
Right.
Afterwards, the guy's notes are basically like, well, I can see you got a stage presence. You're comfortable on stage, but... Man, you that was just rude. That wasn't even funny. It was just rude. And I went, all right. And he said, work on your act a little more. So I did. I
mm-hmm.
sat down and actually gave it the old college try.
Yep.
Sat down and tried to write bits
mm-hmm.
and you know, stories. I was going to go for more stories
mm-hmm.
than jokes because I don't really fancy myself a joke writer. And I did it 3 more times. Twice more at Flappers, 1 more time over at Second City Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I went, all right. I tried.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, the first time I got on a stage for theater,
mm-hmm.
I felt a connection and I understood something that the other people in the class didn't understand.
Sure, sure.
And the first time that I did improvisation, I got up and I understood something that the other people in the class didn't quite understand.
Right.
And I didn't have that experience in stand-up, and I went, okay, I have too much respect for the guys that do this properly and do it well to come up here and go, well, I got experience, so I'll just bullshit my way through it. I thought, this is much like Eddie Murphy trying to do a serious singing album.
Right.
It's offensive to people who are actually musicians.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So I'll pull back and say, thank you very much for your time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I tried.
Yeah.
I'll never have to wonder what it was like.
Right.
You know?
I mean, there's nothing analogous to it, though. I mean, I feel like improv and straight theater are at least analogous to one another. There's nothing really analogous to stand-up.
Right.
What are you going to do that's going to prepare you that you might have already done?
I think the closest thing to it would be being a solo musician in a subway station.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, you practice this, you're ready to go, and here's an audience that may or may not give a shit about what you have to do or say.
My proctologist, he used to be a photographer. He took my x-ray, told me to bend over and say cheese. Proctologist, what a job that is. You start at the bottom and you stay there. Now, I'll tell you, with doctors, I never hit it off, you know. I told one doctor, one of a vasectomy. He said, with a face like mine, I don't need it. Are you kidding? I know I'm ugly. I asked a waiter for a doggy bag. He told me to just sit facing the wall. I'm ugly. Are you kidding? Halloween, I open the front door, kids give me candy. I mean, are you kidding? I know when you're ugly, all right. I mean, are you kidding? Well, last Halloween, a kid tried to pull my face off. And my kids, they flip a coin to see who has to kiss me goodnight. I know I'm ugly. You kidding? Four gay guys saw me and went straight. I mean, my dog found out we look alike. He killed himself. Are you kidding?
I love what Jerry Seinfeld said in that comedian film that he did when he was starting over. And he said, or maybe, I don't know if it was he or Colin Quinn, but one of them in their conversation said, you get 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You get 2 to 5 minutes up there where they go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing Jerry. And after that, it's make me laugh, fucker. I'm not.
Right.
What have you done lately?
Yeah.
I don't care what you did before.
Yeah.
Do it now.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. You said that earlier, that the whole idea of the contract and that people do get angry if you're not funny, which is so. It's oddly ironic because of what comedy is supposed to do to you. But I do suppose it is supposed to be a catharsis. You're paying for a catharsis. You're paying for therapy in a way. So
right.
I guess it's not the same as drama.
Right. And in improvisation, at least the way it was taught to me, you know, through the glasses of Del Close, you know, the way he taught it to his students. I only had Del Close for 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then he went into the hospital
and
died. So. I was in the very last class he taught.
Wow.
And he, for those who don't know, Del Close was basically the father of modern long-form improvisation.
Yeah.
And he borrowed someone's inhaler because he was having a hard time breathing, yelled at another guy for not covering his mouth when he yawned, said he was tired, asked for a ride home, and that was it. He went to the hospital the next day.
Holy shit.
And so I didn't learn much from him. I learned a great deal in a very short spurt.
Sure.
You know, one was to dress professionally on stage. Be funny, don't wear your funny shirt
on stage.
That was one of the things I learned. So I try to dress like I'm going to a job interview.
Right.
When I do an improv show. If you don't do that, that's fine. That's your business. But that was what I was taught.
Yeah.
And then he also said that improvisation was more like basketball than it was like theater. It's really more like, you're the center. You kind of have areas that you play in. You can go anywhere, but really, we know where we expect you to be.
Yeah.
And we've rehearsed these plays. And if we all kind of play our thing, then we'll be able to win this game.
Yeah.
You know. And that made sense to me.
Sure.
But the people that he taught me that your first job is to be believable.
Mm-hmm.
That contract is, I'm getting up on stage, and you're going to believe me when I tell you that I'm the father of this guy over here who's playing my daughter.
Right, right.
And you're going to believe him that he's my daughter. Provided you go on that trip with me and believe that, you may laugh at some of the things that you find familiar in your own father, son, father, daughter, husband-wife relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where the comedy is. And if you don't laugh, at least you will believe us and you'll find that experience enjoyable.
Yeah.
Provided, of course, you haven't had too many old styles after the Cubs game.
Right.
You know.
Right. Do you out of curiosity, I mean, like you said, you tried stand-up, you respect it, as do I. I've never tried it. I don't think I don't think I could do it. Do you ever, I mean, can you still listen to something like this and draw any inspiration even though you don't do that?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I...
Just simply for being funny?
This is what was beautiful about this. I got your email
mm-hmm.
3 or 4 days ago, and you said, I finally found Rappin' Rodney, and I went, oh, my God. What a great opportunity for me to be forced
mm-hmm.
to look at comedy in a different way again for the first time in a long time.
You know,
I've been kind of a snob in the last few years. I'm very unhappy with the state of film comedy.
Yeah.
I think all the heroes in the film comedies are fucking idiots. I'm not talking about the actors. I'm talking about the characters.
Right. Yep.
The characters are, oh, I'm so dumb. I did this dumb thing, and now I'm dumb, and we're all laughing because I'm dumb. Let me talk to my dumb friend who's dumber than I am. And then the straight man comes in and goes, oh, you guys are all dumb. And the whole audience goes, ah, I lost my house. Oh, thank God. And they escape, and that's great.
Right.
But I'm, you know, and I'm guessing if you're listening to this again, you're not your average comedy fan. You're probably one who dives deeper into comedy and is not as pleased with things that are just about stupid people doing stupid things and then shouting.
Right.
So I've been frustrated in the last 5 or 6 years
mm-hmm.
with the state of comedy. And I think that I look at guys like Paul Feig and mm-hmm. I look at guys like, well, they're the same family, but Judd Apatow, right?
Yeah.
And I look at the way that those guys do comedy.
Yeah.
And I'm brought right back to where I was when I started in improvisation, and they forced me to go, I believe you first.
Yeah.
I trust you.
Yeah.
And now you're playing some part of my life up on screen,
mm-hmm.
and I'm forced to either laugh or cry based on what my memory of this thing is.
Sure.
I'm laughing, the guy next to me is crying.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or girl.
Because
guys don't cry. But, so this forced me to look at comedy in a different way again
mm-hmm.
because Rodney was old school, set up punch, set up punch, set up punch. Like I said, on the way over here, I turned it on. The first 38 seconds are him being introduced and the audience clapping and him mm-hmm. going, hey, come on. Thank you. Thank you. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. And they finally delivers the first joke at 38 seconds in.
Uh-huh.
And by the time a minute 38 has passed, he's gotten 6 laughs for 6 jokes.
Jesus.
That's 1 laugh every 10 seconds. And I thought, well, maybe that's just the first minute. So
right.
I listened to 2 minutes, and there were 14
Shit.
Laughs at 2 minutes, and then it was back to 23 after 3 minutes, and then it was 30 after, or whatever it was. It was 29, and then, so it stayed on that 6 laughs per minute average, which means he's going, hey, what do you think about this? I put this thing over there. And then he gets the laugh.
Yeah.
You know? I told my father I was tired of running around in circles. He said, shut up, you're making me mad. So he nailed down my other foot. You know? My father and I, we used to play tag. He'd drive.
that one,
which is one of the greatest jokes on the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you got to think
yep.
for a second. He forces, in that one moment, he forces you to think a little bit.
Yep.
And the audience doesn't really respond. And he goes, come on, work with me here, keep up with me. And it's like, it's funny, he's already conditioned them to be used to very simple, very simple, very simple, very simple. And then he goes on one that forces you to go, oh, he'll drive? Oh, your dad tried to hit you with a car.
Right.
You know, and they don't really laugh at it mm-hmm. as much as you would like.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is, and it's in the song, Rappin' Rodney, when mm-hmm. he says, my wife is so, oh no, it's at the end of the act before he goes into uh-huh. Rappin' Rodney. He said, my wife is fucking dumb. You want to know how fucking dumb she is? It took her an hour and a half to watch 60 minutes. That's fucking dumb. And this one they get.
Yeah.
He's conditioned him now to be ready that he might hit him with something that
yeah.
requires a little bit of thought. Wait a minute, an hour and a half is longer than 60 minutes. That's what's funny.
Right.
You know? So it forced me to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And in looking at it, I thought, my God, how brilliant this guy was. Also, just the fact that it's at no point is he making fun of anybody else.
Yeah.
No matter who he picks out of the audience, because mm-hmm. at the end of it, he kind of goes on a tirade where he's like, you, what's your deal? Where are you from? Where are you? And everything he says is, oh, Toledo. Oh, I got weighed there many times. You know, he could make fun of you for being from Toledo, from a shit town in the middle of a shit state or something.
Yeah.
He doesn't do that.
Right.
He makes fun of himself again.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got this self-effacing humor the entire time.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm guessing is probably what got him through high school.
For sure.
You know,
it's got to be.
Without
it,
he's a dead man.
Right.
Those big buggy eyes,
mm-hmm.
goofy voice, big puffy lips.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Shit, I'm sorry. Give me a second. Again, I'm gonna write down the time this happened in the episode so I can cut this part out. I always fucking brain fart right about now during the episode. I was gonna ask you about, like, his character. I mean, character wasn't exactly the same thing for guys of his generation.
Right.
You know, he's not doing, like, a vaudeville. He doesn't have a shtick so much as he does, I'm a guy who tells jokes.
Yeah.
I am kind of a, you know, I'm kind of this supposed drug addict scumbag. Like,
yeah.
Which he obviously isn't really that bad of a dude. But, I don't know, do you ever, like, sit and think about stand-up characters that much? Or, like, specifically his? Or is it just roll
like
off
who they
bat?
Really are on stage?
Yeah, I mean,
who they really are when they get off stage.
Yeah, you know, I always wonder where they're drawing from. Because it's not the exact same as an actor. I mean,
right.
he got to use this character in his movies, too, you know,
right.
to an extent. So
I think, you know, you listen to a guy like Marc Maron when he talks about stand-up.
Yeah.
And that's also the other thing that got me really fascinated with stand-up again, mm-hmm. was listening to Maron.
Yeah.
Doing his podcast, talking to these people and getting them to reveal their deepest, darkest
it's
secrets.
So interesting.
In a way that, you know, who was it? Adam McKay said to him, or Apatow, mm-hmm. one of those two said to him, I don't know, I feel safe. This feels like you're just going to lose this and you're never going to air it, so what's the harm?
Right.
The way he got them to talk about themselves,
mm-hmm.
and Maron talks about building your clown,
uh-huh.
you know, and I, as cheeseball as that phrase sounds,
yeah.
and I'd never say that to his face because he'd probably eviscerate me and I'd just be left with expletives is the only way I could really,
yeah.
you know, defend myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a cheeseball saying, but I understand what he's saying,
yeah.
is the Marc Maron that's on stage, as much as he would like you to believe that's who he is at the grocery store, or maybe, I don't know if he does or not, but isn't really who he really is. It's
sure.
That's the guy that gets the laughs.
I mean, it's a tough racket, showbiz. I started in showbiz, it was in ventriloquism. Then I had to quit. I got too big for the guy's lap. I mean, today it's different. Today I finish a show, I sign 30, 40 autographs. Nobody takes them, but I sign them. I never got girls when I was a kid in show business either. One girl told me, come on over, there's nobody home. I went over, there was nobody home. I mean, I never got girls. You know, my friends didn't know, though. I fooled them. I used to go to a drive-in movie alone and do push-ups in the back seat of the car. Now, I tell you, with girls, I don't think right. One girl told me, I got mirrors all over the bedroom. Come on over and bring a bottle. I brought Windex. we finally made love. I said to her, how many guys been before this? She said to me, not enough to make up for this. And I tell you, this girl, she was no bargain either. She was fat. How fat? Well, she went swimming. She left the ring around a lake. Okay, she's fat, I'm telling you.
And I know this from this last year. I've been working on a series
mm-hmm.
With Jim Jefferies.
Yeah.
Who's a, you know, very fucking talented stand-up.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And Jim pulls from the truth. Jim stands up there and tells you all his deepest, darkest secrets on stage.
Yeah.
You can't get through.
Uh-huh.
Because he tells you everything on stage. He's far more vulnerable on stage mm-hmm. when he's telling you his deepest, darkest secrets than he is off stage
yeah.
when he's sitting there with you. When he's sitting with you, he's picking at you. He's getting this thing. He's getting you riled up.
Uh-huh.
He's an older brother
okay.
who's trying to get you charged up so that you come into the grasp of the Venus flytrap, and he gives you the noogie.
Yeah.
So I've always been fascinated by... You know, as a kid, I always figured Steve Martin must be the strangest, goofiest, weird guy.
Right.
And he's not. He's just a normal dude.
Yeah.
You know? Never met him.
But
from those that I know that have,
I've never heard
accounts,
a story. Yeah.
Just a regular old dude.
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
who just is an oddball.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which reminds me, you know, I mean, I don't know. Have you seen Legit? Have you seen the show?
No, not yet.
Yeah.
No, not yet.
Please,
please
do.
I will.
We are
I'm
are
going
in a position
to
need the viewers at this point. And we're getting to a point where it's time to make a decision for the network. So we
on
are
on FX. What's the time slot?
FX Thursdays, 10:30 p.m.
FX Thursdays, 10:30 p.m.
It's called Legit, and it's
no. It looks great,
what
and I feel horrible for not having seen
no, okay.
it actually. But
what I love about it is the opportunity to work toe to toe with an actual stand-up.
Yeah,
who's not? I've had a lot of friends in the past who are stand-ups,
yeah.
who are still friends
mm-hmm.
and still do stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a guy that goes and sells out Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
This is a guy that goes and sells out the Nokia. Not the big one downtown, but the
mm-hmm.
other, what's the other one? The theater or the
shit.
Club Nokia.
Yes.
Just a huge place.
Right.
He sold out the Vic for two shows
Jesus.
In Chicago. A place I used to go and smoke weed and drink beer and
yeah.
watch films with 500 other maniacs.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy is selling it out and doing bits that he's creating on his own, which are really just the stories of his own life.
Yeah.
So that's the very long answer to that question, and a very clever way to sneak in my own plug for my own show. It's not shameless. Oh, there's a ton of shame involved in that.
I just wonder where a stand-up like that is, what they're drawing from as an actor. Again, like I said, it feels like... Maybe it's just a feeling I get from watching a lot of 80s movies. Like, as much as I love Rodney Dangerfield, you know, there's a lot of like, okay, this guy was funny. We want this guy to play this character as many movies as we can make money off of. But now it's hipper for someone like him to play a character and like just full on act in a show.
Right.
There probably must have been some kind of a weird changeover for a lot of those older acts.
I think, you know, if I could look at it and put a finger on it, I would guess that a guy like Eddie Murphy did a lot for that.
Yeah.
Because Eddie went from this slick, hot young dude.
I mean,
I'm guessing chicks thought he was extremely fucking hot.
Right.
That's my best guess based on the fact that when I look at him, I go, that looks like probably a hot guy, right?
Right.
And extremely funny and really edgy and all that. And he played fantastic characters.
Yes.
Yeah. And when he did his stand up, he even said, "You're expecting Gumby and Buckwheat and that shit. Well, you're in the wrong place."
Right.
And yet in his films, he would play, you know, 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, that other one. It's the one I'm forgetting.
Coming to America.
Yeah. And there's another one I'm forgetting. But
Trading Places.
It doesn't matter. Yes, Trading Places.
My favorite.
The first one that really got my, jerked my chain and got me going on him. He's playing a similar character to what he does in his stand-up routines.
Sure.
But later on in his career... Say what you will about Nutty Professor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, look at what Martin Lawrence tried to do it.
Right.
Martin Lawrence couldn't pull it off.
No.
It's a Peter Sellers attack on film, which is, I can do all these things. I can do every fucking thing. And he's equally as nuts as Peter Sellers was, from what I understand.
That's also what I hear, too.
But that he can pull it off. That he can make these characters sing. And then you see guys coming through SNL after him, guys like... You know, Farley did his one thing. Farley did the thing that Farley did. Farley wasn't a stand-up guy.
Right.
Farley was an Improv Olympic guy, a Second City guy. But you look at the... who the hell was I going to say? The Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Sandler plays characters.
Sure.
Now, in the majority of his movies, he plays that one character.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The handsome-ish, safe, Brooklyn young Jewish kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know... Who's just trying to get through there, and then Punch Drunk Love comes along.
Right.
And you see the dark side of depression and sadness, and people are going, where the hell's the comedy? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, he did it, and I think...
I love that movie.
Robin Williams did a similar
thing. He did. You know? I mean, he's one that feels like he's all over the place. You know, in many ways. Good Will Hunting, I guess, was the one that... I suppose it, but
before
Garp though, he did Garp, right?
And after Garp was
Fisher King
Vietnam.
And Good Morning. Oh fuck! How am I forgetting that? It's one of my favorite films.
It's largely straight.
Yeah,
Garp is entirely straight.
Yeah,
I mean Garp is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I think that you look at these guys, and they have their shtick, they have their character that they do on stage, and that character works very well in movies. And obviously, Sandler's doing that character in a lot of movies because. It works.
Sure.
And people go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it ain't broke, you're not going to fix it.
No, of course.
Look, we're Steve Guttenberg. You know, if you'd have told me when I was a kid that I wouldn't be able to tell you the last time I saw Steve Guttenberg,
right?
I would have said, you're nuts. That guy's going to be in every comedy for the rest of time. And I can't remember the last time I saw him in a film.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He didn't get bad.
No. But
he just became overexposed or... People stopped wanting to work with them, or they went, well, there's got to be a newer guy that does the same thing for cheaper, or what have you.
Right.
And so my guess is a lot of these guys go, hey, man, I got to strike while the iron is hot and get as many of these things out as I can.
Of course.
You know?
Of course.
Which is why I really respect the work that, like, as much as he can drive me nuts at time with the over-the-top, extremely dumb character, Will Ferrell.
Sure.
In a film like Everything Must Go.
Yeah.
Where he plays... And absolutely depressed, down on his luck, alcoholic, loses his wife and has to camp out in his front yard and have a yard sale just to move on to the next step in his life. Great film.
Mm-hmm.
And he nails it. It's completely believable. And I would never expect that from the guy that did semi-pro.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's always... I always get... I tend to get a little pretentious as far as acting, where I'm always... I like to insist that, you know, it's a lot... It is harder to be funny. It's far harder to be funny than dramatic, I feel like. But I always sort of assume, well... They do comedy. They must be really good at drama. But, you know, some people are proving me wrong.
I don't think so. I think, you know, I've always heard that, oh, it's much harder to do comedy than it is to do drama. I think it depends on the actor.
Yeah.
I think Meryl Streep would tell you it's much harder to do comedy than drama.
Right.
And I think that, I wonder what Robin Williams would say.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I wonder what Steve Martin would say.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder if Steve Martin's experience making The Jerk wasn't easier than Steve Martin's experience making Parenthood.
Right.
You
right,
know?
Right, right, right.
Which he was great.
Sure.
And it was great.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll bet you that was harder for him than the experience he had doing The Jerk. The Jerk, he wrote, he knew it inside out.
Yeah, yeah.
I know for me, you know, again, going back to the series, I'm legit. It's a comedy, and I play largely a straight man.
Okay.
And there are opportunities where I kind of break out and play an idiot, or I play, you know, the buffoon or what have you. And then there are these moments where there's this whole arc where my wife is, you know, my ex-wife, essentially, coming to the end of our marriage. And there's a moment where I had to be emotional and be, you know, torn up. I had to come to tears.
Yeah.
That was way fucking harder than anything else I had to do all season long.
Okay,
you know, in the season finale of the show, my character gets wasted and starts tearing shit up, and there's a lot of funny moments.
Yeah.
Very easy to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Compared to the emotional connection of the other thing,
yeah.
Extremely easy to do. So I've even found it myself where doing comedy was easier just because that's kind of my go-to.
Sure.
You know?
Sure, sure, sure.
Ask Robert De Niro which one's harder.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's going to say comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I'm willing to bet that Sandler would say he had a harder time with Punch Drunk Love
I don't doubt it,
than he did with Big Daddy.
Right, right, right. Did you ever make friends over comedy? Like, just listening to albums with people
yeah.
and just become closer
to
people?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had a whole group of guys that we all got to be friends just because of Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think Jim and I, on Legit, when we started talking about comedy, and, you know, I was intimidated by the guy because he's a world-renowned comic,
sure.
And I'm some clown who does improv in small bars for 15 people, and I kind of like, oh, what do you think of so and so's comedy? Oh who's your favorite comic? George Carlin. Oh, really? Hey, which album? You know, and then boom, like we automatically have this thing between the Beatles and George Carlin. There was a connective tissue that we could just go.
You know, everybody has a tough. Well, hookers are giving away toasters. I tell you, people are nuts. I went to an AA meeting. There was a 2-drink minimum. I tell you, you know the greatest trust in the world? 2 cannibals having oral sex. What are you, a glee club? I did the same joke for the PTA, went over very big. I mean, you don't know who to believe anymore. I got stuck last week, too. I bought a book, How to Make It Big. It was all about money. I tell you, I mean, nothing works out. I go fishing, I catch nothing. I go to orgies, I catch everything. I'll tell you what, girls, I'm never lucky. You kidding? By the time I was 16, I had sex once and VD twice. I had an affair with one girl. I went nuts. I didn't know what to do. I mean, the rabbit didn't die. It just stayed in critical condition, you know?
But in high school, I had buddies that we would talk about Carlin. We would play Carlin and be like, hey, can I borrow your Carlin on campus?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You know, here's, you know, give me your AM/FM. And then we'd, you know, swap
awesome.
Out. We'd be like, that one bit, I haven't even heard that. How is that? I've never heard that bit. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like people who find out that they're both into heavy metal and they go,
sure.
Well, you're into metal? Oh, yeah. And then they have this, you know,
mm-hmm.
this immediate connection.
You miss, though, exactly what you were just miming, just subconsciously, the trading. Like, that's a thing that nobody... And I'm sure people get annoyed with me kind of getting a little too fascinated with having something physical in my hands, but you don't get that anymore. It's
right.
It's not the same as sending a YouTube link. It's
no.
Not as visceral.
And there's something cool, too. When you emailed me the link to the album and said, sorry if there's any skips, and I thought, oh, how awesome. Now, first of all, the thing's almost perfect.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end, there's one little hiccup.
Yeah.
When he's basically saying, all right, I got to go, but I got to tell you. But I got to tell you.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you. Everybody always says, you're a great crowd. You're beautiful. You're, that's bullshit. I can't wait to get the fuck out of here. And there's only that one skip on the thing. And when I heard it, it immediately brings me back to, this is tactile.
Yeah.
This is something you reach out and touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go, you know, I was trying to rewind at one point, and it's like, to rewind on an electronic device, you know, when it's a digital version of it, is to go, too far, too far, too far. Whereas with the records, you go, zip, boom.
Yep.
And you know right where you are. Here's where the track starts, here's where the track ends.
Exactly, yeah. You know? Yeah, and I still have to do that when I'm ripping these two, because I'm also not comfortable sending like a nice crisp version, because I'm like, oh shit, I'm gonna get in trouble, and I'm hosting it on my website. But did you mentioned though that your family's really funny.
Yeah.
Did your parents or brothers or sisters ever introduce you to any particular comedy? Or?
Yeah. Well, my mom and my stepdad were the ones who purchased Bill Cosby himself, George Carlin, AM/FM.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to those in the car, and they had Joan Rivers' Can We Talk?
Oh, okay.
That was that same era. They had those three out on cassette.
Sure.
And we would listen to those three in the car on the way up to Minnesota for the summer.
Okay.
And I would be, when it was my turn to pick the music, I would pick one of those three albums. I want to listen to the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I think my mom's sense of humor was Fawlty Towers.
Uh-huh.
You know, she introduced me to Fawlty Towers. Awesome. You know, my stepdad is quite a bit older.
Okay.
So his sense of humor is completely different. My father's sense of humor was Green Acres.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of difference between Fawlty Towers and Green Acres,
right.
Really.
Right.
When you boil it down
definitely.
Fish out of water,
mm-hmm.
there's one guy, one straight guy,
yep.
running a something in a small town and a bunch of weirdos. Animals and freaks and so forth, and visitors and all that kind of stuff. It's very, very, it's one fish out of the crazy town.
Mm-hmm.
A straight man in a crazy world.
Yeah. You know?
And I took right to both of those things.
Back.
And to the and like I said, with the Cosby and the Carlin and the Joan Rivers. Joan and Cosby were more alike than you would want to think.
Right.
Because they both told stories of their real life.
Yeah,
What it was, you know, Melissa, you ripped me to shreds. You know, And to hear my parents laughing at this and going, oh, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But they're laughing, so there's comedy there. So when I would be alone and listen to it, and I'd try to dissect it, like, what does that mean? There's a moment in Bill Cosby himself where he says, my wife, and there was a mouse, and my wife jumped on a chair. And she said, the mouse is going to run up my leg. And he says, well, who told the mouse that that's where the cheese was? And my parents would go, oh, and kind of giggle under their breath. And I thought, oh, there's something dirty there. I don't know what. I don't know why. And I know this guy doesn't swear.
Right.
So he's doing something else. I didn't understand innuendo at the time. I was probably 8 or 10.
Sure.
You know? And then my brother was a huge Steve Martin fan.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Martin had a special on probably ABC, because that's where everyone's specials were back then.
Yeah.
And Strother Martin was on there with him,
mm-hmm.
doing a bit about wrestling. Instead of being a cow roper, he was a watermelon roper. And all these weird bits. Just really weird stuff.
Yeah.
And my brother would watch that thing till the wheels fell off.
Yeah.
And I would sit there with him. Get out of here. And I'd go, okay. And I'd go hide and watch it over his shoulder,
mm-hmm.
and watch an entirely different being from another planet.
Yeah.
I mean, what Steve Martin did on stage, to this day I listen to it and I go, what in the fuck is that? I mean, there's King Tut.
Yeah.
Rambling Guy.
Uh-huh.
And then a whole bunch of odd stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still to this day I go, what the hell did we think was funny about that?
Right, like, right.
And this guy became the biggest name in comedy,
mm-hmm.
for a very long time. I mean, he was selling out arenas,
mm-hmm.
in a big way. I mean, like rock star status,
mm-hmm.
around the country. You know,
and at the same time was sort of almost poking fun at the audience for laughing at him, you know, like just making fun of stand-ups.
So, never even considered that, but
you know, I mean, but not, and I don't think in a mean way, but in a way just like, you find this funny? Well, I find that funny, you know, it's sort of how it feels.
I think it's funny that you find that funny.
Right, right. Did you, and also I know a couple people have brought it up, is like, what the fuck is that joke that he just, like I'm going to sniff a cat like up my nose, and then there, I did it. Like, I don't, what the hell did he actually do that made that funny, besides just saying it?
Well, it's not like Cosby where you can see what he's doing.
Yeah.
And I don't mean watching the video. I mean,
right.
when you're listening, you can see it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you remember, people like to ask the question, do you remember when you realized you were funny? But I think it's more interesting, is there a point in your life when you realized you wanted to be funny, you wanted to know what made shit funny?
I watched my entire family laugh at my brother.
Yeah.
I watched my brother do things, and I had six brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And my next oldest brother, I was the youngest, and my brother was the second youngest. And he would do things that the entire table was laughing.
Yeah.
And they'd be talking about it the next day. Oh, when Tommy did that. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, man, first of all, he was my hero.
Sure.
Because he was the closest sibling in a very large, crazy house. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it was like, he learned how to ride a bike? This guy's a superhero. You know, they already knew how to ride bikes as far as I was concerned, the other ones.
Right.
I watched him learn how to ride a bike.
Yeah,
that made him a superhero. You know, everything that he learned how to do, I was like in awe.
Mm-hmm.
So when I watched him becoming funny, and I went, I'll just copy what he does.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that I've ever really done that's worked well in comedy, I think what I did on Veep last year, I had a small arc on Veep last year, where I played this extremely misogynistic, angry, cantankerous, racist congressman from Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And the character I attempted to portray was largely what I thought my brother would do with that role.
That's awesome.
You know? I told him that, he was like, fuck you! I said, what do you mean? Listen, this is the best feedback I've ever gotten for any work that I've ever done.
Uh-huh.
And I did it with the most high-profile person I've ever worked with. I worked with Julie Louis-Dreyfus. Yeah. Most of my scenes are with her improvising in the moment with the script, a very strong script.
Yeah.
In the moment, but also a lot of freedom to play.
Wow.
And I wasn't afraid to play because I was in your head. And he's like, bullshit, that doesn't make it any better. And I said, you don't understand my business. If you did, you'd understand that I owe you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I owe you big time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I sent him a check for 25 cents earlier this year. I don't know if you know that rule, but in comedy, and I don't know if stand-ups do it, but I know that in improvisation we always did, I stole your bit, man. I owe you a quarter. And the next time you see the guy, you give him a quarter. And I told my brother that, and he said, I'd like that in check, please, and you can frame it, but make sure you put in the memo why you're writing the check. So I wrote him a letter, a form letter that said essentially a legally binding document that said this check should blah, 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 and here's the date and the time, and here's the,
you know, oh my God,
the amount and all that. And I said, but I can't afford the frame. You're killing me here. The check is already 25 cents. The postage is 30-something. Fuck you. And he said, I'll get my own frame. And a week later, I get a photo of him in his office with pictures of him shaking hands with presidents and shit.
Shit.
And there's the check with him doing the thumbs up, standing next to it, framed, hanging on his wall. And I was like, oh, he really, like, you know, my family supports me entirely. I think that they looked and watched and saw me becoming it. I mean, to use mm-hmm. Marin's term of, like, building that clown, not mm-hmm. being in stand-up, but,
sure,
you know, the clown of what works for me, what mm-hmm. characters work for me.
Yeah.
You know? I think you see these guys that create these characters,
mm-hmm.
and they find out what works through trial and error.
Yeah.
You know, they say no one ever learns anything from their successes.
Right.
They learn from their failures. You mm-hmm. fail and you go, less of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which just means more of the other things until you run out of things that don't work, and then you're just left with what's left.
It's like sculpting in the same way.
Precisely.
Or, you know, you're knocking away bits of stone until you've got the thing
you knock
that you
away
made.
The parts that aren't the sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's one of the best stories I've ever heard.
All right. I'll tell you, my wife in the car, she keeps me broke. You kidding? Who tips at a toll booth? My wife's got it too good. We got married, we were poor, she was better off, you know. How poor? When she was pregnant, she had to hold it in for 2 years, okay? We're poor, I tell you. I mean, poor. Well, we met at a singles bus stop. What, do you want to fight? Want to fight? Give you one more chance. We were so poor in my neighborhood, the rainbow was in black and white. Christmas, we decorated a stump.
I wanted to ask you about Veep because I and my again my audience is going to be annoyed because I bring up the vice presidency a lot. I've been working on a documentary about the vice presidency for like 6 years, so I did want to ask you about it because again I don't have the channel, so I have never gotten to see Veep, which pisses me off very much. So what was
it's out there somewhere? It might be on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm gonna need to hunt it down because what was the experience like? I'm just curious because I mean one of the funny things is it's created by an English guy. I mean to me that's hilarious. But
yeah, if you are a fan of comedy and you've not sought out the works of Armando Iannucci, who is the director, producer, creator of Veep. He had a show with Steve Coogan called I'm Alan Partridge.
Yes, yep.
And also Knowing Me, Knowing You, this character of Steve Coogan played of Alan Partridge has years and years and years of different television programs.
Right.
Armando started this show because, and I don't want to speak out of school, but as I understand it, they had a show called The Thick of It, which you can also watch on YouTube, which I'm sure those guys would rather make money than have people watch it on YouTube.
Right.
But it's there. And it's about the Prime Minister's cabinet, his press liaison and his traveling secretary and so forth. And it's them and they're infighting and they're backbiting and they're bitching and complaining in office politics, you know, except at a very high stakes level.
Yeah.
It's not at a paper company.
Right.
It's in the office of the Prime Minister, and yet they're still children about it.
Right.
So they, Armando Iannucci and Simon Blackwell and Tony Roach and Ian Martin, and I could go on and on and on and on, the list of these genius British guys that are huge fans of American politics and the way they work.
Yeah.
So they wanted to make a film called In the Loop.
Okay.
And so they made a film called In the Loop, which Sigourney Weaver and, James Gandolfini, and it was like the crossing the pond of The Thick of It. Where it was, you know, kind of the chief of staff and the our heads of state. I can't remember which American politician it was that was involved in it. But anyway, they kind of come together with the Brits, and you see this infighting. Well, the film was nominated for screenplay for the Academy Awards, and then they decided they wanted to do an American version of it because they had tried before. Mitch Hurwitz with Christopher Guest had tried to do an American version of The Thick of It, and it didn't work.
All right.
And so Armando was like, I want to be in charge of this thing. So he came over and did it, and they got Julia to play the vice president.
Yeah.
And they'll write a 65-page script for a half-hour show.
Shit.
And you'll sit down and you'll do a table read and you'll do rehearsals, which are you hold your scenes in your hand and you do the lines, and then they say throw the scene away and just improvise, knowing that you have to hit these certain points.
Yeah.
And you're helping them write, and they're guiding you along the way as you're going. You might hear something from any one of the six of them. So it's kind of that Curb Your Enthusiasm kind of appeal to approach to it.
Yeah.
Where you suddenly are creating in the moment a scene that was written 2 minutes ago, and now you're rewriting it in an entirely different direction. And I did one episode last year, and I've done a couple this year. I don't want to say much more than that.
Okay.
But it's a it is the most enjoyable creative process I've ever been engaged in.
Yeah.
Like, the guy's mind, there are a few people I've worked with, and I will absolutely drop names because these guys were saints to work with and comedy visionaries, and that's Larry Charles, who you know works on Curb and worked on all the Borat and
Seinfeld,
all the Seinfeld, and worked on all the Sacha Baron Cohen films, and Armando Iannucci, and Paul Feig, of course, you know, having a chance to work with Paul, and these guys have such an enjoyable experience. It's almost as though what I've been training to do my whole life of like become an actor, learn how to be believable. Now take the chance to step outside of what might make sense in this moment and see what might be discoverable.
Right.
And then tie it together with something that's hopefully smart.
Sure.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And see the package in the end and go, oh my God, this works. Mm-hmm. They weren't kidding. Dell wasn't wrong.
Right.
You know, these guys were telling the truth. It does actually work that way.
Yeah. Do you, is it, I mean, obviously, it's always a learning curve. I know people always like to still get up on stage and practice it, you know, because camera, you can't act for the camera all the time and expect to still be good, I guess.
Right.
Is how much of it is second nature for you? What part of it is second nature for you, the improv part anyway? You know,
I think it's, I mean, when it comes to improv, it was always second nature.
Yeah.
Somehow, that first class that I went to at the Players Workshop in Chicago, I had a comfort of, like, I had six older brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once I watched my brother get laughs, I went, okay, next act is me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Now I'm up. He's off with girls. It's my turn.
Sure.
You know, and I learned how to be comfortable in front of a group of people acting like a fool and not being afraid to look silly in order to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, having done it, I discovered, oh, it's really just about taking that risk and being willing to fail and discovering that even quote-unquote failure on paper can be the genius of the moment.
Yeah.
You know, the slip of the tongue can wind up being the new gem in the piece.
Sure. I mean, as long as, I guess, if you're in the moment and you're good at what you do, it's all going to fit.
Right.
You know, some people just don't know how to make it fit and they shouldn't improvise.
Right, and I think, you know, we always had a thing where we talked about, you know, it's like weaving a basket, but, you know, I guess it was kind of like weaving a basket, but really it was like, you know, what do you call it, like cross stitch or
okay,
or
yeah.
And you make a mistake, you don't go back and fix that mistake that you've made. You just make that mistake again, but on purpose next time in the same place.
Yeah.
And now it's part of the pattern.
Yeah.
You know, and discovering that it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay to have made, you discover that it's okay that you've made a mistake.
Yeah.
Because unless I tell you, oops, that was a mistake, you're going to think we did that on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and how many times I've been on stage improvising and have the mistake become the thing that afterwards people go, that one bit where you were talking about the garage and she said, we don't have a garage. Oh, and then it turned out that you were crazy. Oh, that was great. And you go, yeah, well, that was a total, I was a mistake. She made a mistake. Together we fixed it. And it looks like it was done on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
that's the moment that they think we scripted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't want to keep you much longer, but I did want to ask, we usually ask everybody, and some people, sometimes I've had people say, no, don't listen to the album, it's not that great, but this one's pretty friggin' funny. If you're going to recommend it to people who've never heard it, maybe never even heard Rodney Dangerfield, why would you want them to listen to this album?
I would want people to listen to this album, first of all, because of the genius of Rodney.
Mm-hmm.
Because that in the mid-80s, this guy was doing that 60s and beyond style of setup punch. And because there is at least one joke that you'll remember and you'll wind up finding yourself repeating someday.
Yeah.
Rodney speaks to that part of you that goes, ah, I'm fucking worthless. Oh, why can't I win?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, like I said, that moment where he says, my wife was so dumb it takes her an hour and a half to watch 60 minutes. It's funny.
Yep.
It's quick.
Yeah.
It's smart.
Yeah.
You know, and two, I think that it's like to hear just the track rapping Rodney, where there's the girls in the back going, no respect, no respect. To hear what people thought of what became hip-hop, but back then was just rap.
Right.
What they thought of it back then, and what the 80s thought of electronic music, like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to some Giorgio Moroder now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you go, whoa, this is garbage. But back then, that was cutting edge.
Right, right.
And back then, this was cutting edge. I think this is pre-Aerosmith with Run DMC.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. What year is it, actually? I should have mentioned that earlier.
This says 83.
Oh, shit.
Which I can't believe.
Well, I mean,
because Back to School was like 86.
Oh, really? Damn,
so,
okay.
You know, like that I said, my timeline's all messed up if this is really 83.
Well, I guess it would be. This is right on the edge of, I mean, when Blondie's Rapture came out in 78, 79.
Yeah.
So that was like the thing that kind of hipped it to white people. So I feel like, I guess that makes sense, but...
And because to have a Rushmore of comedy guy on the album cover with a Bruce Springsteen handkerchief around his neck and a torn t-shirt given the Black Power fist with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth with the less than zero sunglasses holding a giant boombox. I mean, it's so classic. And the photos on the back are, you know, hey, Rodney, do your best. You know, you're jamming, listen to the music,
right,
faces.
Right.
Oh my God. There's so many things about it that he's so out of touch.
Yeah.
But his, you know, the gags are great.
Mm-hmm.
There are, like I said, if you don't like a joke, wait 10 seconds because there's another joke and then another joke. And then it's a nonstop machine gun barrage of jokes for 30 minutes straight.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's go through all the plugs. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Yeah, I would have left
remind
that
them about
the
show again.
Yeah. Legit Thursday nights, 10:30 FX. You got to watch that.
Mm-hmm.
The bravest show on television. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be on Veep this year, this season two coming up on HBO. That premieres April 14th
okay.
on HBO. And then just before July 4th, The Heat, which is a Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy film. I'm going to be in that. I can't see anything more than that.
Okay.
Big surprise. You won't even know you saw me, but you'll see a lot of me.
Nice.
And I'm on Twitter, at BackItAll. And that's BackEdahl. Awesome. That's that.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for
doing Absolutely,
this.
Man. Thank
this
you.
This is a lot of fun. Everybody, thank you for listening, and have a good thing.
I tell you, I'm all right now, but last week I was in rough shape. I don't get a break with nothing. I played hide and seek when I was 3.
No respect, no respect.
Why they wouldn't even look for me?
No respect, no respect.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, rate us highly, and write your reviews. You can follow us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl and Twitter at ComedyOnVinyl.
Halloween, I had a trick-or-treat over the phone.
No respect, no respect.
Friends don't call, my phone don't ring. I don't get a break with anything.
What's the matter, Rodney?
Ah, death, where is my sting?
It's just Rappin' Rodney. Ain't rapture tight, no, no. Rappin' Rodney. Get out of sight. It's just Rappin' Rodney. Make no mistake, poor old Rappin' Rodney. Can't get a break.
I'm getting old, it's hard to face.
No respect. No respect.
But during sex, I lose my place.
No respect. No respect.
Steak and sex, my favorite pair.
No respect. No respect.
I have them both the same way, very rare.
No respect. No respect.